7:14, some rain in the area, going to disappear by 8 o'clock, whatever is left. And then it turns warmer today, a little bit cooler tomorrow. Highs a day of, about 70 degrees, then 64 tomorrow, 69 Sunday. And then for Monday of Super Bowl week all the way through Super Bowl Eve, highs in the mid-70s. And no chance for showers, so it should be pretty nice. David Hammer joins us now, WWL Louisiana investigative reporter, to talk about what's going on with the Archdiocese and Second Harvest. Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm all right, Tommy. Good morning.
Before we get to that, I saw you on TV last night with an update on the case that we were talking about, and I wanted to start with that, if you don't mind.
Oh, sure, yeah. There was a lot going on yesterday, Tommy, all at one time in the afternoon. But, yeah, you had me on yesterday morning talking about this investigation that I did over many months about a shooting, a deadly shooting in the Courtyard by Marriott Warehouse District in 2022. Nicholas Harrison was shot to death in a single shot to the head, and his girlfriend, Cache Shelton, was the only one in the room, and I reviewed all this evidence, and she had never been charged, but all the evidence pointed to her story that he had shot himself couldn't have been true. And when I laid all that out a couple days later here yesterday, the DA brought the case to the grand jury, and the grand jury indicted Cache Shelton, the girlfriend, and charged her with second-degree murder. So 2 years... two-year process, this family of Nicholas Harrison has been pushing for action. The police had booked her and on suspicion of murder, but she was never charged. And when I laid all the evidence out this week, it led directly to her indictment. So they'll have to arrest her and bring her in and start the process, and she's presumed innocent until proven guilty. But this is a big development in that case.
All right, let's talk about the Archdiocese, the bankruptcy case, and what's going on with Second Harvest Food Bank. Is it this just every time I think I've heard it, I've heard the most ridiculous thing I could hear. Something else happens. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is probably the thing that's gotten Catholics that I've heard from more angry than anything other than the abuse of children itself. And that's that the Archdiocese, the Archbishop Gregory Ament, has fired several of the leaders at Second Harvest Food Bank because they won't turn over up to $16 million to help the Archdiocese pay its settlements for clergy sexual abuse. And this is something that is, a tough situation because Second Harvest is an apostolate of the Archdiocese. That means it is essentially owned by the Archdiocese. The Archbishop Gregory Ament is the sole member of the corporation of Second Harvest. But Second Harvest has a completely...
Wait, say that part again. The Archdiocese what?
The Archbishop Gregory Ament is the sole member of the corporate entity of Second Harvest. And that's true of all of the apostles. That's true of the parishes and, Christopher Holmes, which is a housing unit that's owned by the Archdiocese. He is the sole member. So he has the authority to fire these people, to fire Natalie J. Rowe, who's the longtime CEO of Second Harvest, and to get rid of board members as he did yesterday. He has that authority. But the question is, what does Second Harvest in its mission of feeding the hungry have to do with the clergy sexual abuse crisis? And, the survivors of sexual abuse involved in the church's bankruptcy case have long said that there are no survivors who are affected through Second Harvest. There are no claims against Second Harvest. And all of this falls back, Tommy, to the fact that the church wants to make sure that after they pay these settlements through the bankruptcy, that there are no more claims against entities that it controls. And so it's trying to bring in all of the parishes and apostolates like Second Harvest and have them pay so that then no more claims can be filed against them for previous abuse. But the point that the survivors make is that there are no claims against Second Harvest. There's no Second Harvest has nothing to do with the clergy who had contact with children and had sexual contact with children over the years. And therefore, it would have no responsibility to pay, and therefore it shouldn't be paying. And there's another big issue here, is that Second Harvest has contracts with funders like Feeding America, the Mackenzie Scott Foundation, that have provided millions and millions of dollars to them to be able to perform their mission of feeding the hungry in Southeast Louisiana. And those contracts specifically say that the money that they get has to be used for feeding the hungry. So if that money is then taken and used to pay settlements for clergy abuse, that could be a major violation of those contracts that could cause Second Harvest to lose that money and have that money clawed back by the funders. So that's these are all big issues, business issues, not related to religion, that are, you know, coming up now. And again, I have not heard this much anger from viewers, you know, average Catholics who are watching this, than I've seen in a long time. And I've been covering this, as you know, Ramon Vargas and I have been covering this for 6 years, doing stories about the abuse and about the cover-up. And, you know, Lawrence Hecker was just convicted of rape and died in prison after a long push for that over the many years. And people were probably more angry to find out that the Archbishop had fired the leaders of Second Harvest than I've heard from people after the Lawrence Hecker case.
See, it seems to me we got to take a break here, but Natalie J. Rowe, who is our friend and has been on numerous times with us, it seems like she got fired for actually carrying out her fiduciary duties as CEO of Second Harvest. Is that an accurate statement?
That is what it appears to me, for sure.
All right, let me take a break.
I haven't spoken to her. I reached out to her. I haven't spoken to her directly, but based on the statements from the board members who were relieved of their duties, that's exactly what they're saying is happening.
I don't know if we've reached out to Natalie or not. I know we were going to try. I know there's also, you know, sometimes some legal considerations when you get terminated and you don't want to come on the air and talk about it. But this is as egregious gets. One line I want to draw, David, when we come back, and you said, and you used the terms interchangeably, I would never challenge you, but just to keep it clear, you said the church, and there's a big difference between the church and the archdiocese, and it kind of goes to companies that have a huge mother corporation, and then they incorporate differently in different states to shield themselves from liability, and to think that the Catholic Church would have to take funding from Second Harvest to pay out benefits or to pay out settlements for their own mishandling of sex abuse cases is beyond laughable, because the assets of the Catholic Church are not limitless, but close. But then when it comes to the archdiocese, it's something different. We'll talk about that. And we did reach out to Natalie and did not hear anything back. That from Jordan Fiegel, 721 Traffic Now, WWL. 7:26 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to David Hammer, WWL Louisiana investigative reporter. Archbishop Gregory Amon replacing top leaders at Second Harvest of Greater New Orleans and Acadiana Food Bank, that the Archdiocese owns, Second Harvest Food Bank, because the nonprofit supposedly allegedly refused to contribute to paying survivors of child sexual abuse by priests. Somebody texted in, David, and said, I guess if these victims want to be paid, the money has to come from somewhere. And I think that's what the Archdiocese is trying to do, make it seem as though, okay, these victims are asking for money. They're going to, as a result, people are not going to get fed now. You're tapping into Second Harvest if you want to get paid. But talk about the finances of the Archdiocese as they relate to the Roman Catholic Church. And look, I've been to the Vatican. I've seen the Vatican Museum of Art. Sell one of those and all of this is over with. But tell me about the way it's set up, please.
Yeah, and here's the thing. From the very beginning, okay, you're making a couple of points there, Tommy. One is that you have the larger Vatican, you have the larger worldwide Catholic Church, and then you have the individual dioceses and archdioceses all over the world. And so the archdiocese is drawing from its own pot of money that's much smaller, obviously, than the Vatican controls worldwide. But there's also the question of how much money the Archdiocese of New Orleans specifically has. And there was testimony. Remember, the Archdiocese declared bankruptcy in May 2020, and there have been dioceses all across the country filing for bankruptcy over the years. So now, 5 years ago, the Archdiocese of New Orleans declared bankruptcy, but they didn't declare bankruptcy because they were out of money. they were very much solvent. The issue was they were trying to protect themselves and reorganize under Chapter 11 of the bankruptcy code that, you know, businesses, all kinds of businesses use to restructure in order to be able to pay all of these claims of sexual abuse that were starting to mount, because up to that point, they were paying people to essentially, you know, settle their claims quietly in the background. And these claims started to mount, and there were, you know, about 34, 35 cases filed in court. Well, now we're talking about over 500 claims that they have to pay that could total hundreds of millions of dollars, that we expect to total hundreds of millions of dollars. And they're in a dispute right now with the, you know, claimants about how much they owe. So they're trying to figure out where they're going to get this money from. They had promised people at the beginning, the Archbishop promised the community that they were only going to draw or mostly draw from insurance. That's not come to pass. And now they're kind of scrambling to figure out where all this money is going to come from. But there are other options about selling property and all of this that they could draw from. And
that the archdiocese themselves could do, not selling Vatican artwork.
Correct. Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Right. And, you know, they control a lot of property in this area, and they could sell that. And there's also the issue of how much money the insurance companies are going to pony up. And that's a big point of contention in this bankruptcy. So I think your point is very well taken, that this is not an insolvent, this is not a bankrupt in the traditional sense organization. This is an organization that has resources. And really, it's about protecting themselves from future lawsuits is the reason why they want to draw in all of the churches and parishes and these entities like Second Harvest, because they want to stop any future claims against those entities that they control.
David, real quick, when it comes to the operations of Second Harvest and their mission, which is to feed hungry people, do you have any idea or do we know what effect that's going to have on that yet?
Well, the Archbishop put out a statement saying it's not going to have an immediate impact. But as I said before, members of the Second Harvest, you know, community are very, very concerned that they're going to lose millions of dollars in funding because this could violate the terms of the contracts that they, where they got the money from their funders, that if it's used for this, that they could lose that money.
So Mackenzie Scott donating $25 million to feed hungry people. They didn't donate that money to pay off a settlement for a badly handled archdiocese or Catholic church that put pedophiles in fertile grounds, right, to pray on.
Exactly. And they have a contract in place that specifically says what that money can be used for. And if it's used for something else, like paying off these settlements, then that money could be clawed back and lost.
Thank you, David. We'll talk more about this in the future, I'm sure. A minute late for news. Sorry about that, guys. That's David Hammer, WWL Louisiana investigative reporter. A little bit more than a minute late. Time now for WWL First News. All right, here we go. 7:47, 13 till 8. Time to help you manage your money with Mark Roser, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. How you doing, Mark?
Happy Friday to you, sir. How are you?
How many air miles a year do you log? Do you have any idea?
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, because I just got my statement. Delta Airlines is my preferred airline. I would reach for them first, but I don't exclusively fly them. And they sent me my year-end summary, and last year on Delta alone was 78,000 miles. And UNO sent me to China toward the end of last year, and I flew American. So that is 78. So probably 100,000 miles.
I don't know where that rate say, get you what? What do you get for that? Toaster?
Well,
what?
Yeah, you get. So Delta told me at 78,000 miles that I was in the top 1% of all of their flyers. It doesn't sound right. I would think the top ones are some people that are on the, you know, a plane three times a day, some nonsense like that, that they're logging in many more miles than me. I'll take it on its face value. I mean, if they said it, I'm not thinking they're lying to me. But it's, you accumulate points, and I do watch my points because I log enough miles for that to be of interest to me. And back to what you were saying before, I have absolutely no, and maybe I just built that way. I do know people that are afraid of flying, and I have no worry about that. It's the least thing on my mind when I get on a plane.
You can't control it anyway, right?
No, yeah, no. Just bring me another martini.
tell you what you can control are your personal finances, can't you?
Yes, sir.
Let's talk about that.
I've been speaking to a couple of friends of mine, acquaintances, business owners, architects, lawyers, and it seemed like, you know, last year it just was enough to bring out a lot of conversation. It seemed just like more than usual, and that might not be as accurate as I want it to be. It just seems that way. And I thought to talk this morning about, you know, just the volatility in the market, volatility in your portfolio, and you and I always segue back to how's my 401k doing? Because that's a lot of times a litmus test for somebody. If the balances are up and I'm doing decently, you know, you feel good about yourself. It's called the wealth effect. And you even, you know, are more relaxed about life many times. If you remember, you and I were saying during the credit crisis of 08-09, 401ks became 201ks. And that we weren't having any fun with that.
Mm.
And so some of these people, colleagues of mine, they're about my age, I'm 65. And they were saying, you know, well, what do you do to temper the volatility? Last year, the markets between the S&P 500 and Dow, they were setting record after record. The markets were climbing. We had in Fed watch, but it was in a good way. I don't like the Fed to be too much involved with the market because they can cause quite a bit of volatility. But it was on the good side of them. They were looking at lowering rates so many times, and the market was just as ecstatic as they could be. But it was risk. Because things turned out that they didn't happen as planned. All these rate reductions turned into very few rate reductions. And then rate reductions going into 2025 have all but dissolved. So that's volatility. So we saw the market max out right after the election, and the election itself was causing some trepidation and volatility just because of its nature. And it's like the Dow hits an all-time high of 45,000 and quickly retreats 3,000 points. Well, the people that were beating their chest when it was at the all-time high were less vocal about it, you know, less enthusiastic when the Dow retreated. So I had an architect friend of mine who was sitting down having lunch. He says, you know, he's older than me. He's probably a year or two away from 70, something, 67, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, you know, I talked to my financial advisor about this, and I said, I need to just preserve what I have. I'm at the point that I'm wanting to skate into retirement in the not too distant future. And the markets tend to be too volatile over short terms. Long term, you see that the market goes up 70% of the time, but in a short term, it could have the volatility that people don't want. And his financial advisor said, you know what? All of the downturns over history have been buying opportunities. You get in, and if you have the courage to do it, you buy in when those things are falling like crazy, and you pick up at bargain prices, and then it reaches another all-time high, and you're very happy with yourself. He says, yeah, but when you're going into retirement, you might not have the ability to withstand another downturn. If you're 40 years old, his investment advisor's age, well, he could make those comments and take that strategy. And it's like, you know, anything. So segueing into a potential solution to volatility, anything that tends to temper volatility is when a company is paying you in cash. What do I mean by that? Bonds are much less volatile than stocks because of the nature of the investment that it is. Preferred stocks are much less volatile, generally speaking, overall, than common stocks. You can get some common stocks that are less volatile than others, and they normally the big stalwarts. I mean, it might be an auto company, it might be Caterpillar. Those that Walmart has done wonderfully over the past 5 years, way beating the S&P 500, and you wouldn't think it. You'd like Walmart. I mean, why is that stock doing so well? Well, it's this huge retailer that's very well positioned in the economy, and people like to go to Walmart. So it's done wonderfully well. But when the company is, when alluded to, when the company is paying you, you know, the tech companies tend to, one, be very volatile because of the nature of their business, but they also don't pay a dividend. All the other investments that I just mentioned, the bonds, preferred stocks, and the large common stocks, large company common stocks, are paying a dividend. Then it's all about, well, how much dividend? Well, some of these stocks, how many people look at, and I'm not recommending it, I'm just pulling one. You know, AT&T tends to have a large dividend. What do I mean by large? It's like 6%.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody's looking at bank products or looking at some other fixed income type of products, and it's like, well, you know, they're not paying me 6%. I might get 2 or 3, and maybe even 4 or 5, but that one is higher than that. You've got some of the other alternatives, some stocks out there, REITs, real estate investment trusts, they've been touted over the last couple of months as, well, they're going to start doing better, and depending on what REIT it is, that's going to be in another segment. We'll talk about REITs, but some of them pay 10%. Mm-hmm. So it's like I'm getting a 10% dividend in cash sent to me quarterly is typical. Some REITs that I own pay me monthly. Every month I get a check from them. So what happens with that is you imagine that money is not exposed to risk. Whatever it ends up being, what if a company is sending you a couple of $100, be it a REIT or be it a bond or be it a large company stock, that you've taken risk off the table. You've got cash in your hand. So that's not like like if you bought a tech company that doesn't pay a dividend at all. You are exposed to the stock's movements, and there's nothing to temper that volatility. So not to get statistical on us, but give us a for instance. Long-term, I'll say it and then I'll explain it. Long-term standard deviation of large company stocks, big stocks, Caterpillars and those companies, is 20%. What does that mean? That means any year they have an average return that's been good over time. It might be like 12, but that's plus or minus 20%. So that any given year you could get a wonderful return like 30, or you can lose money. Okay, those are the large stocks that don't have a lot of risk with them inherently. Now, you go into bonds, and in the case of my architect friend, I'm thinking about him. If he was buying a bond, it might have only a five-year maturity to it. You invest, you buy the bond. 5 years later, you get get your money back. And the standard deviation, the swing, is 5%, mm-hmm. Much less volatile. Not as much to worry about, much safer from a volatility standpoint than some of the equities that we're describing this morning. So a bond inherently, you're buying it, you're in essence loaning the company money, so it's a forward bond, you're loaning forward the money, and it's got a maturity date that the price is going to approach that price at maturity. And you're going to get, basically, unless Ford files for bankruptcy, you're going to get your money back. Mm-hmm. So that tends to, you know, give people ease. If you're worried about this, talk about fear of flying. Some people have fear of investment volatility. And it's if you want that number to be smaller, what number? The standard deviation or just the volatility, depending on how people want to define that, it tempers that significantly. And that's where you see the I don't want to call them old timers. That's not a very nice phrase. But it's the people that are seniors, late 70s. You see them buying bank CDs. I want zero volatility. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So you find yourself segueing into those types of investments. And if you wanted to take all the volatility out of your portfolio, all of it, well, then you could a bank CD would be a product that does that. All they do is pay you dividend.
Mark,
and
we got
zero risk to principal.
We got to run. That's some very valuable information. Yes, I got some calculators at jeffersonfinancial.org that'll help. Thank you, sir. We'll talk to you Monday when we take a look at the week ahead on Wall Street. 7:57. Traffic now. WWL.